Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our ongoing series of alternative healing systems. Specifically today, we're going to examine two areas in depth. The first, natural healing for children. Now think of all the things that your children suffer from that heretofore you were not able to help them with. Burns, chicken pox, colic, colds, conjunctivitis, cradle cap, diaper rash, diarrhea, ear infections, fever, eczema, head lice, hyperactivity, sleeplessness, insomnia, influenza, measles. Those are just some of the things that we're going to provide answers to. Then in the second part of our program today, we're going to take a look at hormones. Hormones for men and women. Also, addressing some of the latest controversy surrounding soy. As you're probably aware, there has been an ongoing challenge to soy, and currently many Americans are simply afraid to use it. Is that fear justified, in part or whole? We'll explore that as well. And time permitting, I'll give you some of the latest on some of the important social issues involving our well-being. And let me talk about one thing. Historically, governments never admit that they have used their citizens as guinea pigs. However, when documents come out and they're faced with their own internal documents showing they did exactly that, there's never any retribution. Never any apologies. It's as if, okay, you caught us, no big deal, but think of all the times you didn't catch us. Continue to believe in us, support us, and we'll continue to lie and abuse you. Something's wrong with this scenario. The power that a few bureaucrats have over the masses is simply unacceptable. In the way it's currently conducted, you would think that we would put people in positions of power who have both the ethical, moral, and spiritual understanding and to not abuse us. But it doesn't happen that way. Example, Reuters, London. Britain's Minister of Defense admitted on Saturday it had used British and Commonwealth servicemen in radiation experiments in Australia in the 1950s and 60s. Of course, this goes absolutely the opposite of what they've been saying for years. They've been saying for years that there has never been any of their men used as human guinea pigs. Well, that's not true. They simply lied. I would like for the average person just at some point to ask themselves, at what point do you no longer accept lying from people that you've been given a position of enormous power and influence over your lives? And why do we accept lying? As if it's, well, it's just a politician or a lawyer or a bureaucrat. There's a standard that we accept that it's okay for them to lie. Should we accept it? Should we be so blasé, so indifferent? Especially when the consequence of their lying can be substantial. Shouldn't there be some consequence to their lying? Right now, there is no consequence. Nothing ever happens to anyone, ever, who lies about anything, no matter what the terrible consequences are. Unless it's you or I. If we lied under oath, we could go to jail for perjury. Any government agency or person within that agency that lies is all forgotten. This comes from Reuters, from Merritt McKinney. Now, this is actually a support of something that I had said about 2 months ago on the program. Many people I counsel have hepatitis B and C, didn't know they had it, and didn't believe that there was anything in their lifestyle that could have contributed to it. Well, for years, we were told that there is no sexual connection between hepatitis C in particular and sexual relations. That is not true. Also, I had suggested that tattooing could have been a route for hepatitis. Here's what they found out. quote, tattooing may be an overlooked source of hepatitis C infections, Texas researchers report. In their study, which was conducted in the early 90s, people who received tattoos at commercial tattoo parlors were 600% more likely to have developed hepatitis C than people who did not have tattoos. More than 4 million Americans have hepatitis, making it the most common chronic viral infection in the United States. Chronic inflammation of the liver develops in 70% of the infected patients, and about 20% of people with hepatitis will develop cirrhosis, a severe and possible fatal scarring of the liver. Cirrhosis increases the risk of liver cancer. Hepatitis C is spread through contact with blood and other body fluids. There's the key, other body fluids. But the route of transmission remains undetermined. Commercial tattooing is an important, quote, missing risk factor in the spread of hepatitis C, says Dr. Robert Whaley, University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Now, here's two thoughts on this. First, I would challenge them on two points. I believe that you probably have closer to 12 million people with hepatitis C. Why? Because 80% of the people who have hepatitis C didn't know they had it until I suggested they test for it. Now, they did suffer from sometimes one person with a sore that wouldn't heal, another person with fatigue, but there was no titers of Epstein-Barr that was elevated, and they had no underactive thyroid, and their adrenal function was fine, and they didn't suffer from depression, and they weren't overweight, and they didn't have food allergies. They'd done those tests, but no one figured to test them for hepatitis C. They were tested. They had it. Elevated titers. Well, when 80% of the people you have evaluate themselves through their medical blood workups find they had it and didn't know it, that is merely an extension of the population, which shows how many people probably have it and don't know it, just like hypertension. So there's where I would say it's grossly underreported. Secondly, they say that it is the most common chronic viral infection in the United States. They're way off on that. Chronic viral infection, Epstein-Barr virus. 90 million to 100 million Americans have it minimally. Second to that, you would have herpes virus. And in its chronic forms, well, you have a lot of people suffering chronic outbreaks, probably about 50 million Americans. You have cytomegalovirus. Probably 50 million Americans suffer from cytomegalovirus with devastating side effects. So right there, you have three viruses more common, and at least 90% more common than hepatitis C. Now, historically, if you went to your physician and told your physician that you have these viruses, the probability would be that your physician would say, no big deal, everyone has these, don't worry. Now, I'm suggesting your physician is not current with the literature. Every single virus has a consequence. Sooner or later, its power upon the immune system and the milieu in which it resides can manifest as a part of the disease process, stimulate it, or be a part of it. So whatever you can do to lower your viral titers is in your best interest. And there are protocols available today that can do exactly that. In the very near future, how near, I'm not quite sure because it's out of my hands, but I would say I'm going to guesstimate 2 months. At the very worst, 3 months, I'll have the definitive book on viruses out. And it's a monster book. And it will be the first book of its kind ever published dealing with what to do. It's not there yet. It's at the printer and the publisher. It took me 15 years to research and write it. And it's just interesting to me that how cavalier we have been with these diseased organisms in the milieu in which we pay no attention. It's like sending a child out to play in a minefield and saying, don't worry, you're not, you know, heavy enough to detonate the mines. And by the way, there's so many other kids playing out there. You're no greater risk than they are. I think that we have just been very, very sloppy in our public health alerts to people. Why, I'm not sure. I can only speculate. Because then we might have to look at what actually causes these and what our immune system would do to reverse some of these, which we can reverse. The good news is we can reverse them, but you have to make some major lifestyle changes. And are we ready to acknowledge lifestyle changes en masse? No, not at this time. Coming over to do the show today, I'm in a cab. Man looks up, sees me, and says, Gary Noll. I said, yes. He said, I'm going to listen to you in just about 5 minutes. I said, all right. He said, I went to see my doctor yesterday. He says, I'm a mess. I'm a mess. He says, I'm 5'5". I weigh 285 pounds. I'm impotent. I love to eat, and I eat crap. He says, Gary, I'm a pig. That's what he said. He said, I'm a human pig. And as he's talking to me, he's eating some kind of junk food out of a bag. He said, my wife loves to cook. She's overweight. We don't exercise. Everything you say to do, we do absolutely the opposite. And he says, now I got heart disease, and I'm depressed, and I didn't leave the house for 13 days, and I'm impotent. And he says, what do I do? When I do leave the house, the first thing I do is go and get the junk food. And I said, what do you listen to my show for? What's the purpose? He said, well, he says, I figure if I'm listening, maybe some good will come from it. I said, has anything ever come from it? He looked at me and laughed, and he said, no. I said, well, what do you have to lose by making some effort? I said, if you're going to be snacking all day, which you seem to tell me you're doing, why not have your wife make up a whole big gallon container of healthy snacks, things that won't put the weight on, but at least satisfy your oral cravings and give you some nourishment. He said, well, I hadn't thought about that. He said, but you know, I like to taste junk food. I said, well, you could actually make some healthy snacks that actually taste like junk food, but aren't. He said, what do I got to do? I said, well, there's a lot of good cookbooks. He said, ah, don't want to take time. I said, well, you could take a class. Nah, I don't have the patience to sit there. I said, but you said you just spent 13 days at home? Depressed, impotent, heart disease? He said, yeah. And the whole time I'm there, I'm sitting in front of a television eating garbage. And as I got out of the cab, I was thinking, well, should I, you know, I have 4 minutes to get on the air. Should I spend a little more time with him? Maybe say something might motivate him? And he turns to me before I could say anything. And he said, you know, I like what I eat. I thought, all right. Some people, you can't interfere in their process. They've made their choices. And there's a consequence to those choices. But not everyone is that rigid. Not everyone's that disinclined to make changes. And if people knew that you could overcome bacterial infections, viral infections, parasitic infections, and gave them appropriate protocols to do so, and if those were encouraged on any level by the larger medical community, I believe we could see some real good health improvements. Hasn't happened yet. Hopefully later this year it will. So next time you get a blood workup done, please check yourself for hepatitis B and hepatitis C. You may not know that you have it. You may think you're fatigued or some local infection doesn't heal, or having a cold that seems to come in and out throughout the year, or flu-like symptoms, or achiness that just doesn't seem to go away completely. It may be masquerading, and it is the great masquerader. And by the way, it kills people. Thousands upon thousands of Americans will die this year of hepatitis B and hepatitis C. So if you do have a tattoo and you didn't do anything else you can think of that could have caused the infection, remember that tattoo may have been contaminated because they don't sterilize those things. Let's go to our first guest. My first guest is Dr. Mary Bove. B-O-V-E. She is a naturopathic physician, licensed midwife, and has a private practice in family medicine and natural childbirth in Brattleboro, Vermont. She served as the chair of botanical medicine at Bastyr University and is a member of the National Institutes of Medical Herbalists. She's the author of the book, An Encyclopedia of Natural Healing for Children and Infants. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be with you, Gary.
Now, before I go into our discussion, since I did a rather prolonged introduction there, do you have any comments, thoughts, challenges you'd like to share with us?
I really liked your introduction, and I thought you gave a really good piece of information around checking that out, because so often it does go undetected.
Okay, thank you. Let's get to the topic at hand. There are so many conditions in children that can be treated naturally without the side effects of over-the-counter or prescription medicines. And sometimes topical preparations are more useful than oral dosing if babies or children are unwilling to take medicines with an unappealing taste. And also, herbal remedies can be far less expensive, offer effective and less toxic than conventional remedies. What are the natural remedies that you have used to treat some of the conditions I mentioned top of the show, like burns, chickenpox, colic, colds, conjunctivitis, cradle cap, diaper rash, diarrhea, ear infections, fever, eczema, head lice, hyperactivity, sleeplessness, influenza, measles, motion sickness, nosebleeds, rosacea, sinusitis, stomach ache, sore throat, and vomiting? I've given you 23 things. Take your time. Go through them. We're in no rush. And I'm sure people at home now are ready to write. And if they don't have children, information they can pass on to family members who do.
All right, great. Well, we'll start with burns. And typically, burns are often, you know, a first aid, or they're happening unexpectedly. So the first thing to do is to cool the burn. And I recommend usually 15 to 30 minutes of either in ice water or cold cloth or compress. And I typically follow that with application of aloe gel. That can be fresh from the plant. You can slice the plant down the long way and open it up, and the gel will kind of ooze out and put it directly onto the burn. Or if you had a gel that came in and already prepared, you could just apply that. Typically, for botanical medicines, herbs that I like to put on as cold compresses, I use calendula flowers or chamomile flowers or peppermint. And if all you have is a peppermint tea bag at home, you could run that under the cool water and get it nice and saturated wet and put it right onto the burn area and let it stay for at least 10 minutes. Often after cooling, I'll follow it up with a cream made of calendula flowers or made from St. John's wort. St. John's wort is an excellent burn remedy, and the red oil from the flowers, if applied every day after a burn, will make a big difference in getting the skin to grow back and heal back normally. That should give you a little sense on burns. We'll move to chickenpox, and chickenpox is a virus, and it kind of gives you a sense of the fact that viruses come in many packages, and many times children who have chickenpox get sick systemically, so that they have to be supported in their immune system. And I like to use antiviral herbs, things like licorice root and lemon balm leaves and echinacea root. These things all help to slow down the viral activity. Plus, they help to support some of the things that happen in the immune system and in having this disease. For instance, lemon balm can help to dampen the fever and make the systemic aching and itchiness that can be used topically in a bath to help the sores to heal up, and it will help diminish the discomfort of the sores on the skin. I always use immune support through bioflavonoids when there's a virus, and particularly when the virus is involving the skin. So bioflavonoids come in the form of a chewable or a liquid with vitamin C, and they can be given about 100 milligrams three times a day to a child who's 5 years older or older. I had mentioned that you could use lemon balm as a compress. You could also use other things topically in the forms of a bath or a wash, things like calendula flowers or lavender flowers or peppermint. Peppermint is very soothing and cooling. So if the skin is hot and itchy, it can make a big difference. Moving on to colic, which is something that often happens for babies. And the baby could, one, have gas or colic from having eaten something or having been exposed to something through the mother's breast milk, or if not tolerating a formula that it could be being fed. So typically, first, before giving the baby anything, I look to see that there's nothing that the baby is being given or exposed to that could be causing it. And if there is something, to remove that first is a good idea. Otherwise, if the baby is a breastfeeding baby, you can certainly feed the tea to the mom and have it go through the milk. And typically, I use a seed tea, which is made from things like fennel seed and anise seed and dill seed. And these herbs, if given as a tea, you can take one teaspoon of these seeds, and you could do a mixture or one individual seed, and you pour boiling water over it and steep it for about 10 minutes. And that can be given in teaspoon doses to the child, or it can be given directly to the mom. She can drink 1 to 3 cups in a day. Typically, if the baby has colic and is suffering from that discomfort, you can use a rub of lavender oil and catnip tincture. You mix them together, and you can rub that on the abdomen with a warm cloth, and that can help to relieve the discomfort. There's often a lot of discomfort going on. Also, a bath used with hops and lavender flowers. The baby is put in the bath and soaked for about 10 minutes, and this will help to relax the spasming that's happening in the gastrointestinal tract. Babies are often really susceptible to what the mom is taking in or something that's being given to them. So typically I'll use teas rather than tinctures or capsules of these herbs for babies. But teas or tinctures and capsules would be used for the mom if she didn't want to take the seed tea. Next, we'll move to colds, and colds come in many packages and forms. You could have a cold that manifested just in the upper respiratory system. That would be a runny nose, maybe an earache, maybe a stuffy sinuses or congested feeling. You could also have a cold that consisted mostly of lower respiratory tract infection, which would be have coughs, fullness, may have achiness or pain in the chest, trouble breathing, things like that. Sometimes they're caused by a virus, sometimes they're caused by a bacteria. And that would make a difference in how you might treat someone. Influenzas can turn into colds or can turn into flus. So I'm going to kind of cover a number of things. If the cold has a fever, we could talk about what to do for the fever, addressing the cold. If it's an upper respiratory tract cold involving the nose, involving the throat, involving the ears, and you know it's viral in origin, you might look to give things that work as antiviral. So again, you want to go back to supporting the whole immune system. So things that are antiviral are things like, as I mentioned earlier, echinacea, lemon balm, licorice, also something called linden flowers. And thyme, just like cooking thyme, is also a good antiviral. And if they're all mixed together, you can mix an equal parts, one part of each of those things together. That can be used as a elixir, as an antiviral to support the immune system. And then each of those have an individual effect. For instance, thyme in the upper respiratory system will help to decongest and act as an antiseptic. So not only does it bring an antiviral quality to the formula, it helps to decongest. You can use things like ginger and garlic syrups. Those are made with sugar or with a sweetener such as honey. And they are used in small amounts to help to sweeten up the formulas. Often that's an issue for children. So immune-enhancing herbs that have antiviral qualities that you might choose other than echinacea and lemon balm and licorice could be astragalus root and old man's beard or usnea root. If there's fever with that and a lot of congestion, maybe fluid in the ear, I look at using linden flowers and elder flowers and elderberry as part of that, because it works to help the mucous membranes to be stronger. And with runny nose and sore throat, that can be an issue. Typically, I'll give a syrup like that, a half a teaspoon to a teaspoon, 3 to 4 times a day. With lower respiratory colds, again, you could use a syrup or a cold cough formula that supported the immune system, as well as to break up congestion and to move things out of the lung, or to help to diminish spasticity of a cough. So if the cough is spastic, one might use something that like hyssop or thyme or catnip to help to relieve the spasticity of that cough. But at the same time, you might give things that are warming, so things that are warming, such as yarrow flowers and lavender flowers, could be used to help to relax the musculature from the inside. I always have them use a chest rub, something that has essential oils in it, such as peppermint and thyme and eucalyptus or rosemary, that can you can get several of them over the counter and put on at night before going to the bed. Both back and front can really help to relax the musculature of the rib cage and allow for an easier night. That same chest rub is excellent applied behind the ear when somebody, a child, has an earache. So if they have an ear infection and there's fluid there and you want to drain it out, if you use that chest rub, a eucalyptus vaporous type of rub along the backside of the ear and down the neck area, and put a little warm heat, it can make a difference in helping to open up the eustachian tube and let that fluid drain out. And that will make a big difference in helping the ear resolve from its infection. Often with ear infections that repeat themselves with children, you'll find that fluid tends to be there chronically. And if you can get rid of the fluid, you can often stop that cycle of the ear infection repeating itself. With ear infections, you know, you want to not only treat internally, but you can also treat locally, for instance, with ear oil made from mullein flowers, calendula flowers, St. John's wort flowers. Typically, you can find these over-the-counter, herbal ear oils. Always remember to warm those first. That would mean that you want to bring it up to body temperature, because cold oil put in the ear is quite uncomfortable. Also, you want to make sure that the ear is intact, and if you have any reason to suspect that the eardrum has ruptured, you would not be putting the oil into the ear. Continuing on that vein of thinking about ear infections and colds and coughs and flus, some remedies that work for fever, which is something that comes up a lot for children, because children have a very active immune system, and they are dealing with types of diseases that often bring fever as part of the dynamic. Understanding that the fever is an immune response and that the body is working with the fever to try to get hold of the infection, you might ask yourself, is this fever one in which the child is cold and trying to get warm? And if that's the case, give things that are warming to the body, like catnip and ginger and yarrow flowers. These things will help to get the body warmed up, which is what the body's trying to do, which will work with the fever. If the body's sweating and cool, trying to cool down, elderflowers and meadow sweet herb and chamomile flowers can be used as a tea and given nice and hot while the child is trying to cool down, and that will help the child to sweat. They're diaphoretic, so it helps the body to sweat, and it will help the body to cool, again, supporting the movement of the fever. Other things that can be very helpful with fever, one of the most common teas that I use are equal parts, one part of elderflower, one part of linden flower, and one part of peppermint. And I mix that with a half a part of catnip and a half a part of yarrow flowers. A part could mean a half a cup, or it could mean one teaspoon, as long as they're equal throughout. You mix them all together in a jar, so you'll have a bit to use later on. And then you take 1 teaspoon of it, mix it, pour boiling water over it, about 8 ounces, and let it steep for just about 3 or 4 minutes. If you steep this tea too long, it will get bitter, and you might have to put a little sweetener in there, or the child might not take it. One last thing that I often do with fevers is that I might use a cooling or lukewarm bath. I tend not to use hot or cool, but kind of body temperature. Often in the bath, I'll put lavender oil, a few drops of that, and that often helps to resolve or to help the child to be more comfortable in their fever. I'm going to look at cradle cap next, which is another condition that babies or infants get more than older children. It is typically associated with the sebaceous glands of the head, and these glands are getting active since the baby has just come from the area of being in water, and now it's living in the air. And when they start going, they can over-secrete, and there'll be a buildup of the waxy substance that gets onto the scalp. It's very hard to get off. Some of the first things that I tell the mom to do is to look at her diet and make sure that she doesn't have any food allergies or any intolerances to foods, because often if that's the case, that can create a symptom such as cradle cap in the baby. Next, look to see if the baby is reacting to something that they're eating or being exposed to. Make sure that the essential fatty acid quality of the mom's breast milk and or the baby's formula, if that they're being formula fed, is good, meaning that you might want to get some more omega-3s and 6s. Often these children do better with that. Biotin is the other piece that I look at. Typically, I would support the baby or the mom with biotin supplementation, as biotin can sometimes be an important nutrient. Typically, I'll look to try to give that to the mom in the breastfeeding baby. For a remedy that you can do, there's a herb called Viola Trick and Viola Tricola, which is known as Johnny Jump Ups. And this plant, used as a tea, can be washed onto the scalp. It can also be given as a teaspoon to a tablespoon 3 times a day. And it helps to mediate or quiet overactive glands in the head. Also, we tend to use an oily mixture where you actually take some olive oil that's had plants infused in it. Typically, it's used of calendula oil, or you can use St. John's wort oil. And it's applied to the head and left on the head overnight and then taken off with a dry washcloth or a comb in the morning. So we'll move on to diaper rash, which again is another baby one. Typically children who are wearing diapers under the age of 12 or 15 months tend to have diaper rash. Again, if diaper rash is occurring, I also need to ask the mom what's going on to see whether or not is it occurring because there's an allergy to the type of diaper they're using or the type of detergent or something that the mom could have eaten if she's breastfeeding or the formula, or could there be a yeast involvement where there's a yeast rash, or could the urine be too caustic for the skin? All of those things would help to find out why is it occurring and to break a cycle if that's the case. Typically, topically on the diaper rash, I try to recommend not using cornstarch because if it's yeasty or candida in origin, the cornstarch could make it worse. I do recommend using bentonite clay or ground calendula flowers and lavender flowers put into a clay base for a powder. You can get some good non-talc-based powders for babies over the counter, which you could use. Keeping the diaper rash dry is important. I typically tell the moms to wash the baby with warm water or warm calendula soap and water, and then make sure that they're dried very well. Use a little bit of powder for drying, not too much, and then to put a cream on. Typically, I'll use calendula and chamomile flower cream or yarrow flower cream. Baby's bottom cream is one that I like. You can get over the counter. Has a little bit of zinc oxide and some shea butter in it, and can make a great difference in helping to protect the skin from the outside elements as well as to heal the skin directly. The Diporest, the other thing that I usually recommend the moms, if the babies are drinking a lot of juice or diluted juice, particularly orange juice or citrus juice, to get them off of that. And to give the baby a few minutes every day of air drying so that they're without the diaper, so they have a chance of really getting some fresh air to that area. Next on our list would be diarrhea. Diarrhea or loose stool in a child can be caused from a variety of different things, and I think it's really important to figure out why is it happening, if it's due to a food intolerance or to food poisoning, for instance, or something of that nature, then always looking at what could be the cause, such as if it's not food, you know, typically dairy products, I would say, can be a very big cause for diarrhea in children. And so looking to see if that could be part of the problem or if that's part of what the children's taking in. Secondly, looking to see, is there something else that's causing that diarrhea? Is it an infection or a flu? Is it that the child is teething and they have copious amounts of mucus that they're swallowing? That could be a reason for it. Or, for instance, they could have diarrhea if they were upset or emotionally nervous or stressed. And that could be a presentation. Typically, when looking at diarrhea and figuring out what is going on, you then want to kind of support the stomach itself. So I use Acidophilus. I typically like to use Lactobacillus Acidophilus with some Lactobacillus Bifidus, because Bifidus is the predominant type of Acidophilus that resides in children's GI tract for their first few years of life. So, and because you want to replenish that type of good flora, you want to make sure they get both of those. And you can get those over the counter. You want to get a good type that is typically refrigerated. They do make some that are stable out of the refrigerator. And there's one type that I use a lot, which is called Culturelle Lacto GG, which is available in many pharmacies across the United States, that can be very helpful in chronic diarrhea. So if you're trying to figure out what the problem is, or if there's been a parasite infection or a gastrointestinal flu or infection, this is a particularly good strain to use. For remedies for the diarrhea themselves, we use teas that are astringent in herbal medicine. We call them astringent, and they're things like blackberry root or raspberry leaf tea. Sometimes I like to have the mom use carob powder. Now, that needs to be unsweetened, and you mix the carob powder with a little bit of applesauce or with some water and a little cinnamon, and that can be given as a tea several times during the day. Remember that you want to make sure that the child is having diarrhea, you know, several times in a day. If it's acute, that they are taking fluids and replacing some of the fluids they're losing. So that would mean not just water, broth, diluted fruit juice or vegetable broth, and herbal teas, things like that. Give the Acidophilus three times a day, until the diarrhea is gotten under control, and then you might give it once a day for several months following. Lastly, a nice gruel is made from slippery elm powder, and you take the slippery elm and mix water with about a teaspoon of powder. Sometimes it takes up to a tablespoon or two tablespoons to get the powder to mix in and be in a nice consistency. You can add a little carob powder and a little cinnamon to that, and that can be given as a gruel or as a weak tea, and that will help to diminish any type of burning or hotness. So if the diarrhea is hot or burny or caustic to the bottom, one could try that. Ginger drops can sometimes work. And last of all, if you don't have any of these botanical medicines, you could make rice water. And that is made by cooking 1 cup of rice in 4 cups of water. You strain the liquid off, and you use a half a cup of the liquid itself three times a day, and that will help to bind up the stool. Sometimes you'll find that you need to use one or two of these remedies at a time, that it takes a couple of things to get it to respond. So we're going to move on to eczema, which is would be a type of skin rash. It can be dry, and sometimes it can be wet, and often it's very itchy. When treating children, a couple of things you want to remember is that you definitely want to help them get rid of the itch, because that's what they are thinking about, because often that's disruptive. But at the same time, if you are going to treat it topically, you also want to remember that it is a symptom or a voice of the body that's saying that something's not quite in balance inside. And so looking to figure out what is causing the eczema is very important, particularly if the child has hay fever or asthma or has had cradle cap, because it's often due as an allergic response. And if there's a food allergy or a detergent allergy or a chemical or environmental allergy, it's really important to figure that out. Also, these children usually need extra supplementation of essential fatty acids from raw vegetable oils or flaxseed oil or cod liver oil. Typically, that's 1 teaspoon to 3 teaspoons a day, depending how old they are. I often look to make sure that these children also have the acidophilus that I spoke about earlier, because it really helps in getting the skin and the immune system stronger by having this acidophilus be very prevalent in the gut. Bioflavonoids, 100 to 500 milligrams daily, will help with the inflammatory process of the eczema in the skin and stabilize that. I like to use herbs, either in the form of tincture elixir, that build the immune system, particularly around the skin area. Things like astragalus root, reishi mushroom, and calendula flowers all work very well there. And to help with the acuteness of eczema, if it's just flaring up, if you use burdock root, you can make a tea, 1 teaspoon of the root, simmered in 8 ounces of water. You simmer it for about 10 minutes and then strain it off. You can sweeten it if they need to have that sweetened. And give anywhere from a quarter cup to a half a cup 1 to 3 times a day, and also wash the area in that tea, and it can be very helpful in getting it to soothe down. Other topical treatments would include calendula creams or oils. I often like to use yarrow flower and chamomile flower, or essential oil of chamomile mixed in almond oil if they don't have an almond oil allergy, and you want to make sure that if it's allergic in origin, that you're not putting anything on the skin that they could be reacting to.
Mary, you've given us so much information, but we're going to have to do a part two on this, because the depth that you're going into, which is great, so I'm going to invite you back for part two, because you still have about 8 things to do, but we have another guest, so we're going to invite you back. And in the interim, do you have a web page?
We do. It's www.bratnat@togethernet.
www.bratnat.
Yep.
Dot. What?
It's at togethernet.
At togethernet.
Yes, and it's BRATTNAT, BratNet, all one word.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Nice to have you on.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Mary Bove, B-O-V-E, author of an Encyclopedia of Natural Healing for Children and Infants. Now let's go over and say hello to our next guest. She is Rita Elkins, and Rita's a researcher, women's health advocate, and she's written more than 40 titles on natural health, and she's been a major herbalist for the past 10 years. Let's go over and say hello to Rita. Nice to have you with us today, Rita.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be with you.
Let's talk about what are the dangers or risks associated with conventional hormone replacement therapy, and how can eating natural products, including soy, help to regulate a woman's hormones naturally and also go into some of the controversy because soy is taking a beating right now and people are concerned.
Okay. This is probably the question that I get asked the most after doing research on this particular topic. It's so confusing to women to really separate fact from fiction as far as synthetic replacement therapy and soy, phytoestrogens, etc. One thing that I want to really stress to all the women that are listening, because so many of them that are approaching menopause right now are actually in menopause, have not made up their minds. The reason being is because there is controversy. The latest studies on HRT are not encouraging. Now, I could make a great big huge case for why you should avoid synthetic hormones if it's at all possible. And of course, the medical profession for years has said that a woman needs to take estrogen after her estrogen has dipped to an all-time low, which is post-menopause, to protect her heart and to prevent osteoporosis. It also does things as far as keeping the skin a little smoother, anti-wrinkling, and then there's a little link now with a study to Alzheimer's or to memory. So obviously estrogen is very important, even post-menopause. The question is, how do you replace it? And I know that on Good Morning America and on various shows now, Dr. Nancy Snyderman, various female physicians as well as male physicians are saying, wait a minute, there's some real disturbing data. A new study showing that women that take HRT for extended periods of time have a much greater risk of ovarian cancer, not to mention the breast cancer problem. If you have that a history in your family, you're advised not to take any synthetic estrogens at all, plus the blood clot factor. Anyway, you can go back and forth on this, and you can find studies supporting both sides, but the latest consensus is that you should not just go on hormone replacement therapy because your doctor says it's what you do after menopause, that you need to weigh the options. And as far as I'm concerned, I think that the cons outweigh the pros. And I've done a lot of reading, and like I say, there's confusing, conflicting studies. Let me just tell you one that's really kind of engaging. A 2000 issue of International Journal of Fertility and Women's Medicine brought out the fact that the heart estrogen progestin replacement did not significantly reduce coronary events in women taking it. So if you're taking it to protect your heart, there are studies out there that challenge that. If you're taking it to strengthen your bones, there are studies out there that challenge the estrogen progestin contribution. So with that said, let me just say that I do believe we need to do something, that we shouldn't do anything, but that phytoestrogen containing plants like soy and red clover are the way to go, combined with exercise and a good diet, and leading the kind of life that will give you that boost you need. The phytoestrogens in soy have the ability to both, let me put it this way. They have an incredible paradoxical effect, meaning, unlike any synthetic drug, when you take a phytoestrogen into your body, it can mildly stimulate an estrogenic effect. So even though it's not as strong as your body's own estrogen or a synthetic estrogen that you put into your body, it accomplishes a similar effect. But it does so in a way that if you're estrogen dominant or you have too much estrogen premenopause, it can attach to receptors in the breast, making it less likely that the strong estrogen gets on there and prompts, you know, bad effects like proliferation of cancer, etc. We know that estrogen is responsible for a lot of bad things in the body, tumors, cancers, etc., and plus all the PMS scenario that I'm sure a lot of the women are very familiar with. Now, when you take a phytoestrogen, you can help with that effect, and post-menopause, you can stimulate some estrogenic effects that you need. Heart protection. Soy is a fabulous heart protector. Not the isoflavone content necessarily of soy, but the protein lowers your cholesterol. The biggest killer of women post-menopause is heart disease. So if you take soy, you're getting a dual benefit post-menopause. You're getting an estrogenic effect that helps with osteoporosis, hot flashes, etc., dryness, but you're also protecting your heart in a safe way. Now, as far as controversy, let me just give you my opinions, because it's inevitable that when something hits the market and it starts to dominate as far as its benefits and sales, that you're going to get some of the contradictory studies or some of the scary stuff that often emerges. Yes, you want to be aware of those things, but let me put them into perspective for you. First of all, let me just kind of shade things a little bit as far as what happens. You can get on Medline right now, and you can find a study that tells you that taking vitamin C may have a connection to cancer, beta-carotene, calcium, the vitamin E might not protect your heart, that it might actually hurt your heart. So there are always, if you're looking, studies that can show some sort of a potential downside of what is a very valuable nutrient. Same goes for soy. The two main things that I've been talking to women about are the fact that one study I know hit Medline, and then the New York Times featured it, concerning that if you take soy postmenopause, you can proliferate or prompt the multiplication of breast cells, which means that, you know, that might be something that you would connect with forming a tumor in the breast or eventually breast cancer. Well, that's a scary thought. And right away, everyone starts panicking and say, oh, my gosh, you know, I bought soy milk. I'm eating tofu. What am I doing? Breast cancer runs in my family. I can't, you know, eat miso. And I say to them, look at the study. Look at the methodology. Look at the source of where the study's from. And then compare it to the Asian model of women that have been eating soy, you know, huge amounts of soy for generations, including their teenagers. Look at the hundreds of studies showing that soy isoflavones actually bind with breast tissue and prevent the growth of cancer in a number of ways, not just by bumping bad estrogen off of those receptors, but also by keeping tumors from growing, by activating all kinds of chemical reactions that prevent this abnormal replication of cells. I tell them that, yes, you don't want to overdo soy because soy is a powerful food, and yet the likelihood of that is so remote. My main concern is that somehow the scare tactics get women away from something, a food as wonderfully, with so many wonderful benefits as soy, and then they turn to perhaps a synthetic estrogen, or they're drinking a lot more milk, thinking that that's a better source of calcium. And in reality, the soybean offers a whole array of benefits for women. And there's another study saying that too much soy kills brain cells. Well, I don't see where there's too many brain-deficient Japanese and Chinese men walking around and women. You've got to use your common sense here. You look at the Asian model. You think moderation in all things, meaning don't go too low, don't go too high. I usually tell women that if you stay within 35 to 65 milligrams of isoflavones daily, that's a good place to be. And let me just say this. Someone else might debate me on this, but I'm taking it. I've done research for so many years on this topic. Would I be taking soy every day if I felt there was a risk? No. And I'm not taking estrogen replacement therapy. I'm 51 years old, and I'm facing all of these issues. So I don't know if I've answered your question, Gary.
That was fine.
All right.
Let's go on to another issue here. What about taking certain isolated soy compounds in supplemental form? And what about soy and heart disease? Are there benefits to it?
All right, let's talk about isolated isoflavones like a genistein supplement or one that has some datezine and genistein. The jury's still out on what the effects, especially long-term effects, are of isolating a particular compound out of a whole food. We do it all the time. We've done it with various phytonutrients. But as far as soy is concerned, there's some question there. So what I tell women is that it's always superior to eat the whole food because you've got the synergistic array of the isoflavones and the proteins and the calcium, minerals, etc., and Mother Nature knows what she's doing. Plus, when you eat soy, even if you were to overdo it and have a lot of phytoestrogens in your body, they're excreted readily in your urine. The body kind of knows how to handle natural phytoestrogens as opposed to artificial ones that you get in, you know, pollution and dioxin and plastics and in synthetic preparations. So for that reason, I say if you can, try to eat the whole food. The supplements are where you might be delving into an area where we just don't know whether taking genistein alone might stimulate some breast changes that would not be positive. Now, I say to women all the time, look, if you're not going to eat soy at all and you've got a soy supplement, I almost would say, look, at least take the supplement rather than doing nothing. But I hesitate to say that because perhaps that's not a wise a piece of advice. My advice basically is learn to love soy, and there's so many available forms of it now that there's no excuse not to have it on a daily basis.
All right. Now,
heart disease. That's
yes.
What we were at. All right. There's the jury's not out on heart disease. There's absolutely no question now that eating soy protein protects the heart. And it does so in three different ways. It helps you to eliminate cholesterol out of your body. It also helps to lower LDL, which I always call the least desirable cholesterol. And it keeps HDL levels at a good where they are. It doesn't lower them or do anything that's negative in that respect. The FDA in 1999, I think, made the approval that now soy products or foods with soy that contain so much soy protein can now say that this may actually be heart protective, similar to what we saw with oat bran and various things. Now, in order to get that kind of clearance, you know that it has to be something that shows clinically to be pretty impressive. Now, for women, like I said, and for men also, the fact that you have this cholesterol-lowering effect is something fabulous because you're getting also the isoflavones for hormones, you're getting some calcium in there, and then you've got this heart-protective mechanism with cholesterol. I've got a study here I just pulled out that talked about, it's not the one I want, but anyway, let me just paraphrase it for you, that you can significantly reduce your cholesterol levels if you eat so much soy protein per day. Also, I might mention now, I know you didn't ask me, Gary, but with men and heart problems, the prostate connection to soy is something that men need to know about. That's becoming a major concern now, especially with baby boomers going into the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we have got not only menopause that's looming and is going to be incredibly affecting so many of us, but men need to look at prostate protection. Soy isoflavones do the same thing in the prostate gland that they do in the breast of a woman.
Rita, we're out of time. More information, they'll have to get your book. Rita's book is called Soy Smart Health. 1-800-777-2665. Thank you very much for being on today.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you for listening today. If you'd like to just write down today's show number, I don't have a place to order it yet, 2758. We'll be back tomorrow sharing more on health and nutrition. Have a nice day, everyone.